This is Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow. BP says the flow of oil from the runaway Gulf oil has been halted, at least for now. But even if no new oil is being added to the water, there is still a lot to learn about the millions of barrels that are now part of the Gulf ecosystem. Like, how much oil is in the water? Where is it going? How is it getting there? What happened to it? These are some of the basic questions that a team of top ocean scientists would like to get answered. They've come up with a plan to study the spill. The problem is they can't get the money, about $8.5 million, or to start collecting the data and something. What's holding that up? Here to talk about it now is Ira Leifer. He's the team leader of the Deep Spill 2 experiment. He's also the chief mission coordinating scientist for the NASA Airborne Remote Sensing Response Team. And he is a marine scientist at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He's talking with us today from Washington, where he's just given a talk on the remote sensing of oil to NASA. Thanks for talking with us, Dr. Leifer.
Good afternoon, Ira.
Tell us about your journey and your mission and what you would like to do. What is the plan that you would like to get funded?
Well, what we're trying to do is hypothesis-driven science to understand where, why, and what of regarding the oil spill at the seabed throughout the water column. Where does the oil go in the deep sea, in the middle of water column, slightly near the surface, at the sea surface, and in the atmosphere? But more important than where is why. Why does it go into the deep sea? And try to understand and learn from this regarding, say, hydrate effects or evaporation or dissolution in the deep sea so that we can understand what's happening to improve models, predictions, and response. And finally, what in which different components of the oil are going to go in different places. And we'd like to know and understand why the more component of the oil that are toxic go in one area versus another, since that's what actually causes the damage to the ecosystem, the more toxic components.
Mm-hmm. Well, this gusher has been going on for weeks and weeks. Is no one actually studying these to answer these questions?
There are a lot of scientists who are out doing measurements and measuring different aspects. What I put together, which to my knowledge is not been done or proposed, is an integrated scientific experiment. So the problem is that the people, for example, who might be looking at the sea surface to try to understand how globs of oil get into the subsurface and float under the sea surface, they need to know what's coming up from below. The scientists studying that or have their own needs. And so what I try to do is put together a very coordinated package so that the answers from one area can be immediately fed into the experimental design for another area. Sort of the integrated part is how you leverage and synergistically learn far more scientifically about the mechanisms.
So this is, you know, the bad news is that you have this oil gusher, but you're trying to find some sort of silver lining in that you can have actually conduct an experiment to study how the oil moves in such an unfortunate situation like this.
Yes, I think of it as that if we learn from this horrible catastrophe, then when some accident occurs in the future, we'll not repeat the same mistakes, for example, of Exxon Valdez. And in 2000, there was Deep Spill 1, a small release experiment to try to understand exactly these processes that we want to study. That study had technical difficulties and weather did not prepare, provide definitive answers. And so the rationale remains the same. That study was not repeated, that we need to have a large integrated study to actually understand the processes of this kind of an event from the event, not to study the, so to speak, damage of a tornado after a tornado is gone by looking at the smashed houses to learn about tornadoes.
Now, your project has a price tag of about $8.5 million. That doesn't seem to be very much.
It's very, in the scheme of things, it's not significant at all. And I do not believe that price is any of the problem that we've been having in getting BP to support this. Congressman Markey has indicated that BP should, in fact, fund something of this nature as an important way of determining response, figuring out how much oil is out there, calibrating the important work of the flow rate team, and so on. And I think more of the question comes up, is BP trying to prevent this kind of science from happening, not from a financial point of view, but from they'd rather not learn these kind of things that we'd hope to learn.
Mm-hmm. And so Congressman Markey of Massachusetts, correct, has asked BP to contact him. And
yes.
Any response so far?
The same response, no, none, just silence.
Huh. So. And I guess time is of the essence here.
Time is of the essence if the experiment is to be able to study the real actual of catastrophe. Otherwise, I believe that we'll take this team and attempt to do the study at some time in the future on a natural seep, which, of course, is much smaller, or possibly in another country elsewhere if there's another oil spill. I'd also like to, you know, propose that science experiments like this and many others should be contingency plans so that when there is an oil spill, they're immediately implemented with funding from one of multiple sources available. So rather than 3 months into an event trying to discuss how to do it, but from day one, science and learning so that we can be more prepared for the future is a critical part of the mission.
The fact that BP has stopped the gusher, at least temporarily for now, seems to be holding. Does that make your work still relevant?
The work would be, I mean, it will be relevant for the future, but in terms of having something to study, if they've completely stopped it, we would have the opportunity of looking in the midwater column and upper water column where oil is still moving along, and then doing the other components at a natural seep. I'd also like to mention that we would integrate this into the NASA response, the remote sensing data that's been collected using new techniques to map oil and figure out how much oil is on the sea surface. Mm-hmm. And that as well could also be done at any time. And one of the nice things is that BP does not control the airspace.
Do they control the water space? I guess what I'm asking is if you got the $8 million you needed, would you have access to the space on the water that you need?
I would certainly hope that we would have access to the space on the water and to the site. However, we came up with a contingency plan should BP, after funding the experiment, decide not to give us access, that we would then go to a natural seep area in not too far away where I was doing research this last summer and add methane and create a system that we could study there as well as studying the upper water column mm-hmm. surface properties, what's happening to explain why there's oil at other levels. But yes, in that case, the dominant purpose will have been thwarted, I would say, by BP.
How is it that BP can deny you access to the Gulf of Mexico?
Well, I assume what would happen is that miraculously certain critical operations would somehow be scheduled during the time when we were there. I mean, several of our team members have conducted scientific experiments and investigations in the vicinity of the well in the last month. And so there's no safety or a reason, objective reason why the experiment could not be done. And we would be very happy to work with any logistic requirements of BP. But I would always be paranoid and worried that something would miraculously crop up at the last minute that would prevent our team as we steamed to the site from actually doing any science at the site, in which case we came up with a backup plan to go nearby.
Why isn't the federal government helping you out? Like, for example, NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, why aren't they partnering with you to do basic research that's right in their Gulf?
I mean, I think, well, there are two things. So one is the mechanism, which I can't claim to be an expert, but we would need to set up a funding mechanism that is not the normal approach, which takes a long time because of the urgency. And there certainly are NOAA assets that could be used to help, but there are also things that we need to contract and so on. The plan as well is that in collecting this data, we would widely integrate it with other NOAA and scientists from USGS and elsewhere to try to make sure that the results that we have are leveraged. And one of the reasons that we sought to distribute the plan widely for is not just to bring it to the public's attention, but also to other scientists so that they could know what we were doing, contact us, and then we could design a better experiment.
So are you looking still for input from other scientists?
Most definitely. And the current plan, which is primarily focused to maintain itself focused on the physical and chemical properties and processes in the water column and surface and atmosphere. Really, we would hope and desire to link that up with scientists who are studying the ecosystem impact and biological effects that we have not put in the plan just to keep our focus.
Mm-hmm. And if other scientists are listening, they'd like to see a copy of the plan, they can go to our website at sciencefriday.com, which has a link to your plan. So are you optimistic you'll get the money, or do you, you know, it's going to be another science failure?
Roller coaster waves of optimism and feeling not optimistic, and then new things occur. I think even if we do not get to do this experiment this time, the exercise will have been worth it, and there are other ways to try to learn these things, mm-hmm. not the ideal, from natural seepage, because, I mean, it's estimated that 600,000 tons of oil enters the world's ocean from natural seepage every year, which is comparable to this spill. It's globally distributed. So many of these aspects could be learned from those small seeps that are widespread.
All right, I'm going to have to stop you there, Dr. Leifert. Thank you for taking time to be with us. Good luck to you. Ira Leifert, the team leader of the Deep Spill 2 experiment. We're going to take a short break and come back and talk about hackers. Stephen Levy's here. I'll ask him about the iPhone press conference today also. So stay with us. We'll be right back.
Director Christopher Nolan's last film, The Dark Knight, was such a smash hit that expectations are running high for his new movie, Inception. It's a sci-fi thriller about an agent for hire, played by Leonardo DiCaprio, whose specialty is entering people's minds while they dream and extracting their secrets. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
In Christopher Nolan's Inception, Leonardo DiCaprio plays Dom Cobb, whose name sounds like it should evoke something. A colleague suggests Dumkoff, but I don't think that's the intention. Cobb's specialty is plunging into people's minds while they sleep and extracting corporate secrets. His new client, a business titan played by Ken Watanabe, wants Cobb not to steal an idea, but to plant one in a rival's head. That's called inception and is believed, even in this futuristic world, to be impossible. Frankly, I got hung up on that. Why should inception be harder than extraction? One character explains the subject's mind always knows the genesis of an idea. But that strikes my mind as dead wrong. I'm highly suggestible. I don't always know where my ideas come from. But there's one thing I'm sure of. Inception doesn't all come from Nolan's mind. It's a clunky mix and match of other mind-bending blockbusters like Mission Impossible, Fantastic Voyage, Dreamscape, The Matrix, with some Freud and Philip K. Dick thrown in. It's not terrible, just lumbering and humorless and pretentious, with a drag of a hero. Cobb accepts the job of planting an idea in a man named Fisher, played by Cillian Murphy, because he longs to see his two little kids in the U.S. and is forbidden to return on account of a crime to be revealed later. And the new client can make the legal problems go away. The best part of the movie is Cobb assembling his team, among them Joseph Gordon-Levitt as the point man. Ellen Page's architecture student, Ariadne, has two functions, dream world designer and exposition magnet. She's the newbie, so Cobb has to explain how the science works. It takes a lot of explaining.
You create the world of the dream. We bring the subject into that dream, and they fill it with their subconscious.
How could I ever acquire enough detail to make them think that it's reality?
Well, dreams, they feel real while we're in them, right? It's only when we wake up that we realize something was actually strange. Let me ask you a question. You never really remember the beginning of a dream, do you? You always wind up right in the middle of what's going on.
I guess, yeah.
So how did we end up here?
Well, we just came from the,
Think about it, Ariadne. How did you get here? Where are you right now?
We're dreaming?
You're actually in the middle of the workshop right now, sleeping. This is your first lesson in shared dreaming. It's good time.
That's my favorite scene in Inception, because it ends with the dream city exploding in puffs of debris and the anticipation of magic to come. But Nolan thinks like a mechanical engineer. Instead of creating one dream that's really evocative, he opts for very ordinary-looking dreams within dreams within dreams. See, in a dream, you can fall asleep and have another dream, in which you can fall asleep and have another dream, except time works differently at different depths. A minute in the waking world might be 10 minutes in the dream. An hour in the dream within a dream, and in the dream within a dream within a dream? Years. The gimmick lets Nolan have three clocks ticking down instead of one, which should be killingly suspenseful. But he's too literal-minded, too caught up in his tick-tock logistics to make a great untethered dream movie. The tone is impersonal, the action disjointed. There is a nice Freudian touch, a female saboteur who keeps popping up in Cobb's unconscious, his wife, Mal, played by Marion Cotillard. She has a great first scene, surveying her malevolent handiwork with glittering eyes. But then the Mal subplot turns grim. She's the key to what eats away at Cobb, so as the team prepares to jump into the head of Fisher, Ariadne has to play therapist. As we go deeper into Fisher, she tells Cobb, we're also going deeper into you, and I'm not sure we're going to like what we find. Dialogue like that does nothing for an actress, and it's the only kind that Ellen Page gets. Apart from Cotillard, the cast is colorless, including DiCaprio, who's often terrific, but is weighing himself down with guilt trip roles. Look, I too wanted to surrender to Inception, but even with some amazing effects, like the city that folds over on top of itself, it never cuts loose the way The Matrix or Joseph Rubin's jolly B-movie Dreamscape did. If you're hoping for a thriller that will take you into another realm, well, dream on.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine.
When the Vatican issued new rules this week making it easier to remove sexually abusive priests, the church was silent on the question of reporting those abuses to the police. The new rules also put into the same category of very serious offenses against the church the attempted ordination of women. NPR's Silvia Pagioli has more from Rome.
The new norms double the statute of limitations for disciplinary action against pedophile priests from 10 to 20 years. The changes, the first in nearly a decade, will speed up church procedures in defrocking abusive priests and for the first time codify the possession and distribution of child pornography as a grave crime under church law. The same penalties for sex abuse of minors will also be applied to abuse of the mentally disabled. Anne Barrett Doyle of the U.S.-based bishopaccountability.org says the new norms amount to administrative tinkering of a secretive internal process.
There's been massive evidence of widespread child sexual abuse within the church. And what the Vatican did today was the equivalent of bringing a toy shovel to an avalanche. And you have internal church policies that are secretive. They don't do much to keep children safer.
Contrary to the expectations of many victims groups, the new norms do not include the requirement that bishops report abusive clergy to the police. Barrett Doyle says transparency is essential.
We need the names of abusers, and we need the names of supervisors who enabled them. Without the names and without the information, there can be no real accountability. And if the church is just secretly removing priests from ministry and putting them in the secular realm, they are merely transferring the problem from within the church to the society at large.
In an unexpected move, the Vatican document also lists the attempted ordination of a woman as one of the most serious crimes against church law, and that it is to be handled by the same Vatican department that deals with sex abuse. Vatican observers say this inclusion appears to reflect an increasingly conservative trend in the Holy See as it reacts to what it sees as growing hostility in the secular West. For example, the U.S. Supreme Court decision to allow a sex abuse lawsuit in Oregon against the Vatican to proceed, and the recent series of spectacular police raids against the Belgian Catholic Church, suspected of having protected many pedophile priests. John Allen is the Vatican expert at the National Catholic Reporter.
Psychologically, the policy-setting class in Catholicism has gone from seeing itself as a majority in the West to seeing itself as an embattled minority. At best, ignored by, and at worst, persecuted by, the culture-shaping majorities in the West.
Allen says the Catholic Church is increasingly aware that it is no longer the chaplain of the West and is now determined to circle the wagons.
While they would say that reforms are necessary for the church to respond to the crisis, they would also say that the top concern of the moment has to be protecting the church's identity so that it is not simply swallowed up or destroyed from within by what they would see as a kind of outright hostile secular climate of opinion.
Allen points to the recent changes in personnel in the Curia, the Vatican bureaucracy, in which Pope Benedict's new appointments are theologians rather than Vatican diplomats. The reshuffle is seen as shoring up traditional doctrine as a key mark of the church's identity. The Pope also created the Pontifical Council for Promoting the New Evangelization, a new department to counter secularism in the West, where, as clerical sex abuse scandals have multiplied, Catholics have been abandoning the church in the tens of thousands. Silvia Poggioli, NPR News, Rome.
And here is a new economic indicator from the folks at NPR's Planet Money. There are now more people of retirement age in the workforce than teenagers. That means more people who remember the start of the DMZ than grew up watching TMZ. And it's the first time it's happened since at least 1948. Hannah Jaffe Walt and Robert Smith with our Planet Money team take a look at what that means.
We'd like to begin this story with an announcement. We here at Planet Money, we're hiring. Robert?
Yes, the formal job title is Human Manifestation of an Economic Trend. We have two finalists for the job. We've got Alice Terry, a 62-year-old teacher in Hillsborough, North Carolina.
I don't think I'm going to ever leave the job world. I honestly don't think so. I don't really have an investment portfolio to fall back on, and I enjoy my job.
And Max Marion Spencer, her 18-year-old grandson with no job, although he's applied for them all.
Quiznos, Wendy's, McDonald's, Harris Teeter, Food Lion, Dollar General.
All turned you down?
Yeah, I would assume so at this point.
And Max noticed something at those interviews. A few older workers who didn't seem to be working that hard.
I mean, I'm not going to judge them and say that they shouldn't have those jobs or stuff like that, but
But you did kind of want to say that you can do it better.
Without a doubt, I definitely could do it better.
Now, if this is starting to sound like one of those Battle of the Generation stories, it is more complex than that. Some of this is just demographics. The baby boomers grew up and are living these long, healthy, active lives.
Normally, that doesn't create too many conflicts because the economy is growing, entry-level jobs are being added.
But not today. The economy has lost 7.9 million private sector jobs in just the last couple of years. The baby boomers are sitting at the top of the ladder, and in a recession, nobody's climbing up. So, if there's only one job available, who's it going to be? Grandmother or grandson?
My people skills are pretty good. What else? I've got wisdom to bring to the table, one would hope.
So, Max, you're facing some tough competition here. What do you bring to the table that perhaps your grandmother doesn't?
You can give me a bad job, and I'll still probably have to keep it because I can't find any other jobs.
So desperation.
Yep, that's definitely one. I mean, I know how to use a computer, I guess.
You bring a future with you. If you have a job that you really like, you can commit to it for, you know, endlessly.
Aw, this decision is going to be tough. I think we need an outside expert.
Here I am.
Well, you know, a strong English accent is preferred for this job.
Oh, right. Well, that's good because I've got one of those.
This is Ian Shepherdson with High Frequency Economics. And he says for Max, this is not just about a job at McDonald's this summer or next summer. Grandma's right. This really is about his future.
Oh, absolutely. Because when they do get into that first job, which they may have had to wait 2 or 3 years for, they're not the front of the queue. They're not going to get the cream of the jobs, which are going to go to the more recent graduates. And they're going to spend a long time catching up. And for some of them, they'll never catch up. So, you know, through no fault of their own, the people who are graduating now are going to find themselves struggling for a very long time.
Alice, if it ever came to the point where you were directly competing with your grandson for a job, would you step aside?
Yeah, of course I would. Yeah, no contest.
Max, do you step aside?
I mean, I think it really depends on the job, but yeah, I probably would, like if she really needed it, because I mean, I have plenty of opportunities and stuff like that ahead.
The good news is that you both got the job.
Yay!
As the Planet Money indicator.
Awesome.
The bad news is that it only lasts a few more seconds, the job. So we need you to end this story for us.
All right,
this might be tough. Closure is hard for us.
For NPR News, I'm Max Spencer.
And I'm Alice Terry.
And I'm Hanna Jaffe-Walt.
And I'm Robert Smith.
NPR News, Hillsboro, North Carolina.
A simple little website called I Write Like has really taken off in popularity this week.
You just type or paste in some prose. The site analyzes the text and tells you that your writing is like that of, well, H.P. Lovecraft.
Or Margaret Atwood.
Or William Shakespeare.
The site is the work of a computer whiz named Dmitry Chesnik, and we reached him on a Skype line in Montenegro, and he tried to explain how it all works.
It's a simple algorithm, actually. It's called a Bayesian classifier.
Dmitry Chesnik says the technology is similar to the way an email program might be able to tell that one message is from your mother and another is simply spam.
But perhaps like a spam filter, iWriteLike's results can seem a little, well, random at times.
Well, it can, Robert. I put a bit of text from my upcoming book, The Grace of Silence, into the website. Here's part of the passage I inserted. Before the alarm clock goes off, before the smell of coffee or bacon finds its way to your bedroom door, there's often a sound outside your window that jolts you out of slumber during the winter months in Minnesota. It's the scrape of a snow shovel against wet cement.
Okay, you put that passage into I Write Like, and it tells you that your prose most resembles what author?
Stephen King.
Stephen King. The resemblance is unmistakable.
Pretty scary, huh?
I tried something that's a bit more prosaic. I submitted part of a memo I wrote in response to an inventory request from NPR, an inventory of recording equipment that I might or might not have in my possession. Part of this memo reads as follows. Second, I do not have the following items: E340114 shock mount, fish pole, pistol grip, battery pack, 12/1 card reader.
And I Write Like said, you write like whom?
Like David Foster Wallace.
The cadence, the rhythm, it really does sound like David Foster Wallace.
In fact, I submitted lots of other things I'd written that weren't inventory memos, and they all came out David Foster Wallace.
Well, there you go. Well, for his part, the site's author says he's working to make some improvements.
I need to put more works of different writers to make it more accurate.
Dmitry Chesnik. His site is called I Write Like.
Stephen King.
They say so.
It's summertime, and for a lot of families, that means road trips. Deciding which states to hit is tricky enough, but imagine having to choose which planets to visit. That might mean a little more long-term planning. But as NPR's Jeff Brumfield reports, scientists gathered in the nation's capital this week to do just that.
It is hot in Washington. But mercifully, the National Academy of Sciences is air-conditioned. Planetary researchers from around the country have gathered here to discuss where they want to go in the solar system over the next decade. Well, not literally. They plan to send unmanned probes to take measurements and collect samples. On the table, everything under the sun, or rather orbiting it.
The missions that we've been studying are just so damn cool.
Steve Squires is running the event, which is being held at the request of NASA and the National Science Foundation. Squires is also the head of the greatest interplanetary road trippers to date, the Mars rovers Spirit and Opportunity.
I mean, we got 28 missions out there that range from Mercury landers to things that fly by Trojan asteroids to landers that land on Venus and then take off and land again, you know, Mars sample return, just a tremendous, breathtaking set of missions.
There are so many ideas because there are so many questions. If Mars used to have water on its surface, researchers want to learn more about it. They also suspect present-day oceans may be sloshing under the icy surface of Jupiter's moon Europa. Jupiter's interesting for other reasons, too. New theories suggest it moved billions of miles across the solar system before reaching its present-day orbit. Studying planets, moons, and even asteroids will help scientists understand how the solar system formed and how life began. Lewis Friedman heads the Planetary Society, which promotes space exploration.
This is all going to lead to some definitive discoveries about life, either positive or negative.
But choosing one mission over another isn't easy. Which would you choose? A nuclear-powered boat cruising liquid methane lakes on Saturn's moon Titan? Or a trip to an asteroid to see whether it's home to complex molecules needed for life?
We want the scientists to sit and argue. We want them to say, this is more important than that.
Jim Green heads NASA's Planetary Science Division. Green says the aim is to get everyone to agree on the most important missions. That makes it easier for the agency to set priorities and to get them funded.
The whole planetary science community will get behind these things, and that will enable us to put the best foot forward.
But getting the whole planetary science community into a room is one thing. Getting them to pick planets is another. Panel member Ralph McNutt.
Gets a little bit intense sometimes.
Are you ever tempted to just do a cage match and put, you know, Mars and Jupiter in a room?
Oh, I think some people would be tempted at times, but it's never really quite come out that way.
It's never come to blows.
It's never come to blows, no.
In the end, the decision isn't all about science. Issues like which missions are closest to being ready and which could be done with other nations must also be considered. And as always, money is important, says Squires.
You could double the planetary budget and we'd still have a tremendous amount of oversubscription. There are just so many good ideas out there for missions that can fly.
The group hopes to come up with their final list of destinations by sometime next spring. Jeff Brumfield, NPR News.
And you can see where scientists want to go next and vote for your favorite destination at npr.org. This is All Things Considered.